Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I am not here this morning. I am catching a bus and a train to Sacramento for a weekend reunion with surviving friends from our Vietnam War exposure to humanity's historical reign of horror and terror upon itself. The attrition upon us now is time and age rather than bullets, mortars, and landmines. We will probably get sodden with drink and memories. But at least one bright spot, the train I'm going to take hit a truck yesterday, so that puts the odds meter back to zero in my favor, and my friend Paul Pappas, who's catching the train with me out of Portland. Well, you probably already know that this is banned books week, and there is no more famous banned book than Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie, who was condemned to die the year it was published in 1989 by Muslim cleric Ayatollah Khomeini. The fatwa that condemned Rushdie reads in full, "I inform the proud Muslim people of this world that the author of the Satanic Verses book, which is against Islam, the Prophet, and the Quran, and all those involved in its publication who were aware of its content, are sentenced to death. I ask all the Muslims to execute them wherever they find them." And as Rushdie said himself, this was not a sentence handed down by any court that I recognize or have any jurisdiction over me. But he realized that didn't matter. And Rushdie is still under the death sentence, but Khomeini is long dead. So I'd like to read an article that I wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, that spring of 1989, about the malignancy of censorship in response to the attempt to ban Satanic Verses through fear and threat of murder that all these years later still overshadows forcibly Rushdie's secluded life. Forcibly secluded life, I should say. So I call my article that I wrote in March 1989, and it sounds so contemporary, that's why I have not backdated it. I call it The Last Smut Show. Salman Rushdie has attained the highest prize for a writer, a death sentence, which makes all other literary awards comparatively insignificant. His book, Satanic Verses, has created an awesome uproar. People riot and are killed. Buildings are burned. And of course, copies of his book and a few bookstores selling it. Other bookstores pull the book off their shelves, though some put it back when writers protest. Rushdie hides from zealous death squads, lured by immortality and $3 million bounty for his blasphemous head. The furor over Rushdie's book has resulted in much extolling of the freedom of ideas and expression in the Christian West. The phrase, "cherished tradition of freedom," is used in articles and commentaries about the frenzied reaction among Muslim populations. The scolding smugness is misplaced. Freedom of expression is paid at high cost and is always threatened with repossession. Not only in Islam do free thinkers lose life and liberty. Just think of a few Catholic democracies, and I put that in quotes, south of our borders, and the death squads our taxes pay to enforce orthodoxy by murdering dissenting writers, poets, and artists, as well as political activists and peasants, and certainly one archbishop. The First Amendment has not prevented attempts to impose religious or political orthodoxy in this country. The excessive repression of the McCarthy era ruined the lives and professions of some of the nation's best writers. Christian fundamentalists have been trying to ban books from school and public libraries for years, and other censorious groups demand control over the contents of school textbooks and the suppression of everything from pornography to Mother Goose. In the matter of life's origins, the pseudo-doctrine of creationism is imposed on school children, despite a Supreme Court ruling that it does not qualify as a science to be taught alongside evolution in public schools. And the reaction to the movie, The Last Temptation of Christ, was on a par with the Muslim reaction to satanic verses. An example of censorship is also the unclean air created by some radio and television stations. January 27th, and remember this is 1989, was to be the day indecency disappeared from the American airways. The thought police of the Federal Communications Commission were poised to swoop down on any radio or television broadcaster who dared mention on the air his or her gastrointestinal tract or its functions, or discuss their most recent sexual frolic. Instead, a federal court of appeals issued a stall order until an appeal to rescind the new decency, and that's in quotes, law is heard in court. The appeal is being made by several broadcast organizations, one of which includes KMUN-FM in Astoria, and the American Civil Liberties Union. They question the constitutionality of the law and its vague definition of what is decent or indecent, and ultimately the right of government to regulate public morality. Until the appeal is heard and resolved, the new law, which would ban entirely, 24 hours a day forever, any, quote, patently offensive, unquote, words or pictures being broadcast anywhere in the United States, and will not, the law, will not go into effect until the appeal. Stations are allowed to follow the current law, a lesser censorship, under which programming that might be considered indecent can be safely transmitted between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. The new law, which was passed by Congress in October 1988 and is called the Helms Law after the great humanist senator from North Carolina who sponsored it, Jesse Helms, bans from broadcast any material that, quote, in context, depicts or describes in terms patently offensive as measured by contemporary community standards for the broadcast medium, sexual or excretory activities or organs, unquote. A federal court found that this generic definition of indecency replaces the famous, much narrower, seven dirty words standard. The court held that what is termed adult material should be channeled to hours when children were most likely to be asleep, not watching television or listening to radio, and would theoretically remain blissfully uncorrupted by the prurience of adult entertainment. Congress rejected the court's conciliatory suggestion and instead voted to ban entirely what it defined as questionable or indecent material. If the Helms Law survives the court test of its constitutionality, it will mean reprimands and fines for stations the FCC accuses of violating its prohibition on indecency and possible loss of licenses. The National Association of Broadcasters and others believe the law is itself a violation of the press and speech freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment and contend that it gives the FCC dictatorial censorship powers. The persistent attempts by government and groups of powerful elites to control public dialogue, particularly in matters of social behavior, has always been dangerous and usually the guise for authoritarian usurpation of the apparatus of communication. Realization of this led directly to the First Amendment, which is only 200 years old this year, remember, 1989. The First Amendment states simply and clearly that government has no right to interfere with freedoms of speech, press, or religion, or with public gatherings. The very power and existence of the FCC quite likely is in violation of the First Amendment. The right to speak implies a responsibility to those who listen. A listener to free speech is free to tune out the speaker, but shutting up the speaker is quite a different matter. Then the listener is threatening the right of the speaker. And as Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, William Rehnquist, wrote in a majority decision last year, 1988, concerning the defamation of religious evangelist Jerry Falwell, who was depicted in a Hustler magazine cartoon performing incest with his mother in an outdoor toilet, which tread upon many social taboos, the First Amendment does not only protect the reasonable, but also the outrageous. The Helms Law is too vague in its definition of decency, and most radio and television broadcasters seldom lionize for courage against official or commercial intimidation, will simply refuse to broadcast anything that might endanger their cash flow. Independent stations that might take the risk in the belief that such thought control deteriorates our beleaguered freedoms will probably be fined to death or lose their licenses and will be hard-pressed to afford the high costs of defending themselves in court. If anyone took stock of the contemporary use of press and speech freedoms, the glimpse should confirm the worst fears of any cynic about the tastes of the greater mass of people. Most of us acquiesce to the most banal, violent, and sexually arousing entertainment. We are addicted to spectacle and blatantly commercial rituals. The contemporary abuse of the freedom of speech is by those who wish to turn the populace into witless automatons in possession of credit cards. These shameless promoters of the inane and unnecessary are the truly malignant carriers of indecency. They are the blasphemous idolaters who appeal to the basest instincts and superstitions of the mass audience to sell a product and make a buck. Little concern is shown toward demanding truth in advertising, nor is much attention paid to the public outcry against television violence. Only against smut, and I make that in quotes, and should have put it into capital letters, does government strike. Matters of the flesh are regarded as unfit for public consumption except in a caricature form of softcore porn. Sex, the real thing, and defecation are repressed as filth. The immaturity of a culture can be gauged by the depth of its reluctance to publicly discuss the physiology of its inhabitants. Human beings often seem unwilling to come to terms with their organs and bodily functions. Contradictory values develop. Eating, even to gluttony, is acceptable to public view, but display of ridding the body of waste generated by stuffing the stomach is regarded as nasty and vile. Most of the time, most of us past the age of 10 think about sex more than any other subject, aside from food, but we shrink in shame and embarrassment at discussion of sexual organs. Our civic Christianity still persists in the medieval abhorrence of the flesh, its soft, sensuous corruption, the cornerstone of Scripture. Yet we live in an age of science that repudiates ignorance and superstition, even as it replaces them with horror and doubt. Ecology, the interrelationship of life, is tacitly acknowledged. We are aware we are parts of nature and live and die in interdependent relation with others, other earthly life. We return to the earth the sustenance we take by jettisoning our waste, which promotes and nourishes other biological growth, which in turn, somewhere up the food chain, replenishes our sustenance. Our used-up bodies return the loan of life by passing on their protean spark. But we balk. We claim to be descended from gods, not ascended from feces. We wish supremacy, not cooperative empathy. This wrong-headed arrogance has put us at odds with our planet, which we despoil with life-exterminating filth and call it civilization. So we invert our sensibilities and values to cope with an unexpected world we have constructed. A bowel movement in our cultural psyche is regarded as more indecent than an oil spill. Genitals, the organs of pleasure and reproduction, are reviled as unfit for public exposure or discussion. But in contrast, we accept the dark visions of horror and death, of violence and inhumanity as entertainment. And we seem obsessed with denying our children exposure to things they most want to know and will eventually know on their own. We disregard our own youthful impatience to learn and grow up and inflict identical deceits we endured upon our children. We wish to shield them from unpleasant realities and attempt to forcibly repress their sexuality, yet we expect them to somehow cope. This exaggerated fear of children learning anything about life is a prime palpitation of government censorship. No one should ever be surprised that a government does not encourage liberty or independent opinion among its subjects. Democracies are only elaborate power balances between ruled and rulers. A most important assumption of a democracy is that the flow of information should not be tampered with nor be restricted. But of course, interfering with and manipulating information is among the highest priorities of political power, which accurately assumes the general populace will not give much thought to mind control efforts most of the time. People who listen to independent radio stations like Astoria's KMUN wish for more than babble shrieking from their radios, and viewers of public broadcasting search for more than the drivel and schlock beamed to the masses by commercial networks. Yet intimidation from the FCC, the gestating Ministry of Truth, Orwell predicted would rise to be the temple of the state, suppresses creativity and controversy. Risk-taking, essential to creativity and independence, shrivels to mumbles of acquiescence. We should remember Orwell. He invented a language, newspeak, which was based on erasing unwanted ideas in the pretense of simplifying the public dialogue. He warned that what is removed from language is forgotten in the individual and collective mind. Orwell was wrong, though, when he suggested that a propaganda system depended upon violent coercion. Instead, in a post-Orwellian world, we suffer the benign control of a powerful system of indoctrination and propaganda that needs little coercion to set an agenda for what people will think about. Policing public morality, claiming, of course, that it is only being reflected, is usually an indecently popular and effective method of intruding control over what we read in our newspapers, listen to on our radios, and view on our televisions, and are ultimately persuaded to accept as truth and reality when, in reality, our vision has been distorted, our perception atrophied, as are our personal values and liberties. That is the real indecency we should worry about. And that was an article I wrote, which I called The Last Smut Show. And it appeared in the North Coast Times Eagle, March 1989. And I should probably put the disclaimer that what you have just heard is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all the cosmos and multiple universes. Now I'd like to read something about another controversial writer who died this last May, Maurice Sendak, and The Wildest Things of All. It's written by Amy Goldman Koss, and the subhead is, a teacher reads the late author's famous kids' book to a group of abused teens who listen like a room full of children at story time. Amy Goldman Koss. Maurice Sendak's death was announced last May, just a few minutes before I was due, at the residential foster home and school where I volunteer teaching writing to abused teenagers. Sendak, the author and illustrator of In the Night Kitchen, Where the Wild Things Are, and other children's classics, once told NPR's Terry Gross that as a kid, he thought that, quote, adults seemed mostly dreadful, unquote. I suspect the kids who find themselves in our foster care system would agree. I go to the school library before the class arrived, so the librarian and I had a moment to grieve about Sendak. She told me that she and her husband had just been talking about his 1967 book, Higgledy Piggledy Pop, or There Must Be More to Life. She said it was that book that helped them throw over their old life and move to California years ago. Our conversation was interrupted by a scream in the corridor, an amazing, prolonged, nightmarish scream produced by a child beyond the brink. I've read about screams sounding inhuman, but this was the first I'd ever heard. There was no explanation. When I first toured the school, I was shown a few small soundproofed rooms, each with a narrow bench bed inside. Details were few, but I was told that the children could be volatile and self-destructive and sometimes needed isolation. When the unearthly screams subsided, I imagined the screamer being ushered into one of those freak-out chambers to roar his terrible roars and gnash his terrible teeth. Transitions from one class to another are delayed when there are disruptions in the hall, so my kids were late trooping in. There were two new faces. Other faces were missing, including some I'd become quite fond of. I'd been discouraged from asking questions about my students' lives, so I know very little about what situations land them here or take them away. I am endlessly curious, of course, about the big, burly, painfully blushing, shy boy who likes art books, the too cool to smile but clearly sweet boy always eager to read his writing out loud, the chatty ones, the pierced and tatted, the ones nodding on meds, the giggly, the sullen, the pregnant. But when the librarian says, "Trust me, you don't want to know their stories. It's best to just think of them as kids," I try to do just that. I asked the class if they knew who Maurice Sendak was, and none did. I asked if any of them knew the book, Where the Wild Things Are, and a few said they'd seen the movie. In 1993, Sendak told NPR, "Children surviving childhood is my obsessive theme and my life's concern." In a 1986 interview with Terry Gross, he said, "Being a child was being a creature without power, without pocket money, without escape routes of any kind." Looking around at the captive young people in this class, his statements seem truer and far more relevant than in most classes I visit. Sendak's own childhood, like the ones he portrayed in his books, was fraught with peril, isolation, and fear. It's appalling but not surprising that many adults have found his vision of childhood alarming and want to keep it from their innocent babes. Sendak's In the Night Kitchen is 25th on the American Library Association's list of most frequently banned or challenged books. When I told my class of Wild Things that I was going to read Where the Wild Things Are to them, there was a little affronted snickering at the idea of picture books for such big galoots. I thought about telling them that Sendak had based the Wild Things on his own Jewish Eastern European immigrant relatives. As he said in a 2004 interview with Bill Moyers, "These people didn't speak English, and they were unkempt. Their teeth were horrifying, hair unraveling out of their noses, and they'd pick you up and hug you and kiss you. Ah! Oh, I could eat you up!" But I didn't give any introduction, figuring Sendak would want these kids to see the Wild Things as whatever demons of their own needed taming. I started reading, and the whole class was instantly silent and still, like a room of children at story time, which is exactly what they were. Listening to Sendak's words, watching his pictures expand to fill the pages and shrink back down again. In Where the Wild Things Are, Max, in his wolf suit, gets sent to bed without supper. But after his great adventure out wilding the wild things, he returns to his room and finds his dinner waiting for him, still hot. Unlike Max, my students can't count on dinner to be waiting for them, but they clearly understood. They understood Max and heard Sendak as clearly as if he were still alive and would be forever. Amy Goldman Costa's latest novel for teens is The Not-So-Great Depression. And now I'd like to do something along the same lines to finish off the program. The High School Bill of Rights. Amendment 1. Students have the right to exercise all rights enumerated in the United States Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and all other amendments, and those established by the United States Supreme Court. Amendment 2. Students have the full freedom of political activity in the high schools. 1. Students may form political and social organizations in the school, including those which champion unpopular causes and regardless of the political and social views of the organization. 2. Students have the right to full use of school facilities, bulletin boards, auditoriums, public address systems, mimeo facilities, to advertise their ideas and activities that take place inside and outside the high schools. 3. Students have the right to plan and carry out forums, assemblies, seminars, and other school programs in order to expand the educational process. These are to be carried out at a time chosen by the students. Speakers may not be rejected by administrators and/or faculty. 4. Students have the right to distribute any leaflets, pamphlets, and political material freely inside and outside the school and school grounds without authorization of the principal or any body of the school administration or the Board of Education. 5. Students have the right to wear any symbol of their political beliefs, such as buttons, armbands, and style of dress, which express their opinions. 6. Students have the right to choose their own method of expressing their beliefs and to refrain from saluting the flag or from attending any assemblies which they so desire. 7. Students have the right to strike. Amendment 3. Students have the right to freedom of speech and the press. 1. Student publications must be controlled by the students and may in no way be censored by the administration or faculty. Editing will be done by the student editors. Any student organization has the right to have access to the school newspaper to advertise its ideas and activities. 2. Student publications, newspapers and magazines, which are not official school publications, are to be treated with the same rights as 1. Above, with full use of school facilities to produce and distribute them. Amendment 4. Students have the right to due process. 1. Students have the right to a fair hearing, which includes representation by counsel, with the right to question witnesses prior to any disciplinary action. The hearing shall conform to all present laws pertaining to court procedure. 2. Students may not in any way be penalized by administration or faculty for any political or moral beliefs which they have or upon which they act. 3. Students have the right to receive annually, upon the opening of school, a publication setting forth all the rules and regulations to which students are subject. This publication shall contain a statement of student rights. 4. Students and parents have the right to see their personal files at any time. 5. Students have the right to appeal any decision on a disciplinary action with a transcript of the trial provided by the school administration. Amendment 5. Students have the right to free elections in the schools. 1. Students shall have the right to run in any school election or for any office. There shall be an end to arbitrary administration requirements and screening of candidates. 2. All students in the school shall have the right to vote. Scheduling of balloting shall occur at a time when all students are present during regular school hours. 3. All students shall have the right to wage a real campaign with full use of school facilities to freely advertise their full election platform. Amendment 6. Students have the right to end high school complicity with the war machine. 1. The student body has the right to be free from the presence of any influence of federal agencies not directly involved in the educational process. 2. There shall be an end to all military programs like ROTC in the schools and to all military recruiting in the high schools. 3. There shall be an end to the use of police to settle disputes within the schools. Amendment 7. Students have the right to help determine their curriculum and evaluate their teachers. 1. There shall be no discrimination on the basis of sex. 2. The tracking system shall be abolished. And that is the High School Bill of Rights by the High School Students' Rights Coalition. And it was put together in 1982. And so by the grandparents and parents of today's current students. And this has been Michael McCusker. I probably will be here next Thursday live. Good morning.